And now to our Friday special, Remains of the Week, with Beryl Wiseman, editor of The Suburban, head of the Institute of Public Affairs of Montreal. And just before we get into that, just wanted to give you a quick heads up. NBC News saying that a Miami is ablaze with rumors that Fidel Castro is near death. U.S. senior officials said that while there are reports on setbacks in Castro's health, there are no indications that his death is imminent. Nothing unusual reported from Havana by the usual Castro watchers, and so on. So that's just a heads up. It's worth nothing more than what it is. Beryl, good afternoon.
Hey, Jim.
How are you?
All right, you?
Yeah, it was crazy and
a bit tired this week, actually.
Nut bar week. Just absolutely nut bar weekend. And what a nut bar day. You know, as you know, the Bay, initial reports, the Bay is collapsing into a vast hole into the Green Line Metro.
It's got to be something to do with carbon emissions.
No, as a matter of fact,
it's a joke.
The rush to judgment.
It was a joke.
Yeah, I know it was a joke. Who's got sense of humor? You know what? That's what we needed this time.
Absolutely. I mean, we have to talk about our carbon footprint. That must have done it.
Well, actually, you know what? Irony of ironies, we've had people say it was because they were cutting a bicycle path down Mason.
I got to tell you something. I came downtown around 2 o'clock, 2:30, and it had been a very busy week, and split my time between Saint Laurent, the suburban offices in downtown, and the Institute. Jim, three merchants approached me. They are dying with that bicycle path. They said nobody can park. Nobody wants to come to. Even if they want to come, there's nowhere to come.
It's unbelievable.
That
I mean, I'm a cyclist. I'm a
popular.
Cyclist. I'm a cyclist, and I don't believe in cycle paths. You know why? Because it gives you a false sense of security.
But besides you
want
a cycle path in the middle of de Maisonneuve on a narrow street with all that bus traffic and fumes?
Well, that's exactly the point. You're better off taking your chances in traffic because at least your head's up. But with a cycle path, oh, no, I'm fine. I'm isolated from traffic. Ba-dang, you know? Anyway. We should not dally any longer. We should say good evening to our guest.
Yes,
David Kilgore, former Secretary of State for Asia Pacific 2002, Africa and the Middle East 97 to 2000. When he stepped down from politics, didn't run in the last election, co-authored with David Matus a study on the Chinese execution of the Falun Gong. Now pushing for a boycott of the Beijing Olympics in relation to Chinese economic and military support for the Sudanese military junta in Khartoum and what they're doing to Darfur with the Janjaweed. David Kilgore, good evening.
Yeah, hi, Jim. It's good to be with you.
So I want to start, what is happening with the Beijing Olympics boycott? Is that gathering any steam or is that
well,
early?
Well, it's an uphill road, as you know, but we're hoping that we can at least keep bringing attention to the terrible state of human rights in China, the Falun Gong community, which your listeners, I hope, know that and I know it sounds terrible, but David Matus and I are completely convinced that it's true. They're being killed a la carte, if you like, and people are flying back to Canada with new kidneys and livers from young women and men who've never been in front of a court. They're just sent off to work camps, and when the day comes when the computer says that you match the patient from, say, Montreal, you're killed by a doctor or a nurse, and they go home with your kidney. And that's any government that could do that to its own people, I don't think is a fit government to host the Olympic Games anywhere at any time.
Yeah, and how do you prove something like that? That's the problem. I mean, I remember hearing about this from China Watch way back. I mean, probably 1998, 1999, 2000. We all suspected we couldn't prove.
Well, Matus and I, I'm not a practicing lawyer, but I used to be a prosecutor. And Matus and I got, I think it's 33 different kinds of evidence, Jim, that most of it comes from within China itself. For example, we've got the wife of a surgeon who managed to get out of the country who told us that her husband removed the corneas from 2,000 Falun Gong practitioners over a two-year period. And then we've got 32 other kinds of evidence. So if you don't like, you know, number 20, when they all say the same thing and nothing says that they're wrong, it's the combination of them all that persuaded us that this practice was going on. And the government of China puts out press releases every once in a while saying that Matus and I are horrible people or this or that or that Falun Gong is a terrible group. They never rebut any of the substance of our report. And now, as you may know, they've been putting out statements saying there'll be no more organs going to foreigners. So, in fact, they're just confirming this terrible conclusion.
Well, you know, I just saw today MSN and Yahoo both agreeing to some kind of blog discipline in China, and I'm thinking, my gosh, so even the so-called free unconfined internet is being reined in by the capitalist concerns of those that want to trade with China.
Google did it a while ago.
Yep. And so did
sadly.
Nortel is one of the worst. Nortel helped them build a wall that keeps people out, that's really, as a Canadian, I'm ashamed of that.
So we got to take a quick break here for traffic and weather together. We're talking with David Kilgore. He's the former Secretary of State, Asia Pacific, Middle East, now militating very strongly for a boycott of the Beijing Olympics in relation to Canada's economic and military support for the Sudanese and other human rights violations. Beryl Wiseman and I, this is the Remains of the Week on The Drive with Duff, 940 Montreal at 6:12. We're back with the Remains of the Week. Beryl Wiseman of the Institute of Public Affairs of Montreal, the suburban editor, David Kilgore, former Secretary of State for the Asia Pacific and the Middle East, now very outspoken on the issue of Chinese human rights and how those extend to the rest of the world. Beryl, I want to drag you in here because last Thursday, the Institute of Public Affairs of Montreal sponsored the Darfur Conference here in Montreal, brought in a lot of really good speakers.
Including David, who has a tremendous voice of conscience.
And I
want to build the link. Okay, you guys, kiss. That's good.
I want to tell you something, Duff. You know how you and I get so cynical and jaded? You know, I still got a year or two to get up to my old brother, Duff, here, Kilgore. You know, it's hard being surrounded by you Scotch Presbyters all the time. But when you were in that room, Jim, and you saw David Kilgore, and you saw Louis McKenzie, and Hillel Noyer from Geneva, and Nazanin, and Payam Akhavan, and Charles Steele Jr., the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, I am telling you, you had... I'm probably leaving somebody out, David. You'll remind me. You had a world cabinet. You had a community of conscience, an international community of conscience. And I tell you, the only word was transcendent.
Simon Deng, did he make it?
No, he's still laid up with internal injuries.
Okay. But now the point, I read something that I think was Stephanie Stein, your reporter for The Suburban, who was covering this, wrote, never again must have some kind of daily resonance.
Daryl Gray's line in the summation of the conference.
That really resonated with me.
Yeah, he said never again must be done every day in every way.
And in every way. And I want to build the link between China and Darfur.
Well, and here...
David, Beryl, why don't the two of you just take it away?
Go ahead, Beryl.
Well, since Jim, you asked me this question and you went right where I was going to take it in the answer. Every day in every way means even when we think that efforts like the boycott of the Beijing Olympics, even if we think that efforts by Canada to say to the world community, not only will we be part of a UN effort, but if Sudan is going to do what it did yesterday and throw out our charge d'affaires, fine, we'll pull our ambassador. Canada's voice has weight. It was proven at the Francophonie Summit last year. Every little act, every medium-sized act, as Robert Kennedy said, is like throwing a pebble in a pond of calm water. It'll create ripples that will come together from 100 centers of energy and daring to create waves that will tear down the mightiest walls of oppression and resistance.
Okay,
that's not just poetry. That's real.
What is the link between China and Darfur?
Boy, you want me to go have a go at that one, Rob?
Yeah, please do,
yes.
David.
Well, I've actually been following both these issues as carefully as I can, Darfur and the issue of organs in China. And the, as you heard, I guess, Jim, the case for China's involvement in this from sort of stem to stern is really deep. They provide aircraft. They have four small arms factories in Sudan. They've provided about $10 billion in investment over the last 10 years for oil. They take virtually all of the oil, I understand, from Sudan, and they provide about 7% of China's oil. Everybody that's listening to us knows that the UN Security Council, the Secretary General of the UN, could do nothing to try to get China to help stop the killing and the raping and the burning and the slaughter of Africans in Darfur. Mia Farrow, and I call her Marvelous Mia, her statement about a genocide Olympics had, as I'm sure you all know, had Hu Jintao sending off some of the cartoon almost the next day. But, and that was fine, but the thing has all got bogged down now at the UN Security Council. And it is, as you both know, the deployment of 26,000 police and soldiers may not happen until the end of the year, and then what kind of a mandate are they going to have? And so there's lots and lots of problems with this thing, but we've got to keep trying it. And the other thing, Jim, that I mentioned this morning is that tens of thousands of people from other countries in Africa are being moved into Darfur to take the farms and villages, or the ones that aren't burnt to a crisp, of the African Darfuris by people who consider themselves to be Arabs. This is capital R racism. When somebody who says that I consider myself to be an Arab, I consider you to be an African, and therefore I can rape an 8-year-old girl, or I can burn a village, or bomb a village.
I love hearing people this committed and this angry.
Jim, do you know what a resignation it was that Sudan did this act yesterday? Do you know what yesterday was, gentlemen?
No.
It was the anniversary of the abolition of the Slave Act.
Oh boy.
Oh.
Yesterday. Had a big ceremony in City Hall here, in many city halls. Hmm. Abolition of the Slave Act.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Well, you know why individual action,
Jim, is important? Not just to give ourselves nice, cozy, warm little feelings in the stomach and that we can go off and smile into the mirror like we're good Canadian social democrats, I said to Jack Layton yesterday. But because it really is effective. Do you know that since the conference, and David has been incredible in this in terms of organizing people, dozens of people who are at that conference have sent hundreds of emails to politicians. It gives politicians the capital, the political capital, to say, we're going to pursue a humanistic agenda. And here's why. Because you know what? It's working with the folks. Because they're talking in Montreal, and they're talking in Montebello, and they're talking in St. John's. Without that talk, without that street chatter, politicians don't have the political capital to be able to say, well, you know, people really are listening to what we're saying.
Exactly. Exactly. Yep. So, David, I understand you can't stay with us any longer.
Well, I'm enjoying it very much. I don't want to compete with Burl.
We have to take a break for traffic and weather. Plus, we have to get in Lou Skeezus with our business analysis for this half hour. I don't know if you can stay to the next half hour of the show, David.
Well, yeah. I tell you what, I'm in your hands. My wife's here. We're going to have dinner, but I'll wait. Which would you rather I did?
All right. We're talking with David Kilgore and he's so involved in this fight to make the world aware, to sensitize that word we love here in Quebec to the excesses, the evils of the Chinese government when it comes to the Falun Gong, when it comes to the economic and military support for the Sudanese military junta, destroying, ethnically cleansing the Darfur region of southern Sudan. This is The Drive with Duff on 940 Montreal. As I said, we've got Lou Skeezus standing by with the business analysis for this half hour. 6:36, Remains of the Week continues with Beryl Wiseman, Institute of Public Affairs of Montreal, the editor of The Suburban. David Kilgore, he's been with both sides of the House, former Secretary of State for Asia Pacific, 2000-2002, Africa and the Middle East, 1997-2000. Co-author with David made a study on Chinese execution of the Falun Gong, the sect now pushing for a boycott of the Beijing Olympics in response to China's economic and military support for the Sudanese military junta. David Kilgore, welcome back, and thank you for staying with us.
A pleasure. Yeah. Can I just stress
that
Falun Gong are not asking for a boycott, because they don't want anybody to think that they are trying to do this, because it'll just bring more persecution down on their heads.
That's a very important point. The Falun Gong, they're doing their level darndest not to make waves, and it doesn't seem to be taking much good, right?
No, exactly.
Yeah. Beryl, out of the Darfur Convention last week that the institute sponsored, mm-hmm. Did you get a sense that there's any kind of heightening of awareness here in Canada that, you know, yes, we should take a leading role in this mission?
If I tell you, Jim, and even David's not aware of this, although through David's efforts and a friend of David's, papers from the conference, articles about the conference have gone all over the continent, if not over the world. We have gotten over something like 6,300 emails from people who came to the conference, have exchanged correspondence with politicians back and forth. That creates momentum. That creates real political capital. And that allows the political class to say, look, we said brave things. We said we're going to join the UN force. And they wait for some resonation with the public. This gives them that. It gives them the ability to go further. Something that happened, like what happened yesterday with the expulsion of our chargé d'affaires. Canada could go the next step.
How do you read that, Beryl? How do you read, and David, how do you read the expulsion of Nuala, name escapes me?
Well, she was doing her job. Apparently she was talking about, can you imagine, rule of law, human rights? And it's entirely consistent with what that government has done on you name it, whether it's the International Criminal Court or making international aid agencies harassing them so they can't try and save people's lives. It's obstructing the African mission for Sudan. It's the mandate of the UN, the African Union troops. They have consistently done the unreasonable genocidaire thing. That's their game, and as it's blunt as it is, that's what the game they've been playing, and they've been doing it since '89, as you mentioned at the outset, when the democratic government was overruled in Khartoum, and these military dictators have taken over.
Beryl, what was the expulsion of the chargé d'affaires? What does that say?
Both and the European Union diplomat. This is what I think it says. And I'm not going to stretch the point too finely, but many people in Europe, in North America, say, well, what happens in Asia, the third world, we can't affect, or even in the Middle East. It's not true. It's just not so. These regimes pay attention to momentum. They're evil, but they're very, very clever. And this may be almost a shot across the bow. The Sudan is seeing the UN act. The Sudan is seeing nations like Canada step up to the plate. They may just want to send a signal saying, here's our pushback. And if you think they don't pay attention to even things like editorials in newspapers, that's not so. And I'll just give you a small example from my life. Jim, you may remember that after the Bahrain conference a few months ago, David, you certainly remember this, where Saudi Arabia said to the West, if you don't play the game our way, the West, the United States, Israel will face the real lords of war. And I wrote a very lengthy piece on that was reprinted in London in the International Institute for Strategic Studies. And somebody delivers me a copy of the Saudi Foreign Ministry's 8-page English briefing paper for their own diplomats. And there's my article.
It is a small world.
It's
absolutely
nothing.
Right.
It's the butterfly flapping its wings in China will make a hurricane somewhere else. So every individual voice is important.
Absolutely agree with you.
David, I want to thank you very much for joining us. Appreciate your time. And best of luck with all of your campaigns. And we certainly are watching with sympathy and with interest.
Many thanks, Jim. Thanks, you, Beryl.
And Dave, thank you for last week and all your work.
Bye for now.
Bye. Cheers.
Bye-bye. David Kilgore with Beryl Wiseman of the Institute of Public Affairs in Montreal. When we come back, we're going micro here. John Iveson, National Post, on Quebec's incessant whining. Well, of course, it's the 30th anniversary of La Loi 101, La Sacrée Loi 101. It's also the week that we saw Bill 104, a sidekick to 101. Struck down by the Quebec Court of Appeal. It's also the week that we saw Quebec wagging the federal dog when it came to policy in Afghanistan. Quebec and its continuing stranglehold on the Canadian body politics agenda. It's 6:41. Yeah, from Falun Gong and boycott of the Beijing Olympics. Let's get to Quebec. This is the 30th. This is the week of the 30th anniversary of La Loi 101, the French language charter. And of course, there's a major, a popular upheaval if you will, with lots of speechifying by a lot of different people. But this also happened to coincide with the week that the Quebec Court of Appeals struck down Bill 104, which is a sidebar to Bill 101, which said essentially that families could not gain admission to the English public schooling system by the back door of enrolling their kids in English private school and thereby getting those kids into the public system along with their siblings. And this was passed, what, 5 years ago, and it was struck down as unconstitutional. Bango! And, of course, Quebec is going to appeal it to the Supreme Court of Canada. But more to the point, they're going to ask for a stay so that this little boy that is affected by this and 25 other families won't get their certificate. Little Satbir Bindra is not going to. He's 12 years of age. He's lived with this for 5 years. He's not going to get his certificate of eligibility. Because that would send the wrong signal, of course. Touche pas la loi 101. And I see that Mario Dumont just this afternoon said that Quebec, if it had its own constitution, would have the same effect on the mentality of Quebecers as 30 years of Bill 101. We need our own constitution. Well, what more does Quebec need? John Iveson has something to say about that of the National Post. He's been taking a French course. Did it stick, John? Good evening.
No, it didn't take with me. I'm a Scotsman, and the English was hard enough. So, the French is still a struggle, I'm afraid.
And you've talked about Quebec's incessant whining and how the rest of Canada perceives of it. But your point of view is what?
Well, I think it, up until a point, people are prepared to put up with this evenly balanced with a chip on either shoulder mentality. I mean, I said I come from Scotland. I understand it. Precisely. It's exactly the same in Scotland. People feel different. They feel that their distinctiveness is not appreciated, and they want it to almost enshrined. And the rest of Canada, I think, has bought into that to some extent. And, Mr. Harper, I think, bent over backwards to buy into that, but I think a line in the sand has now been drawn. People will not go any further, I don't think, particularly when they saw what happened with the money from the fiscal imbalance. When that money went for a tax cut, I think people just said, that's it, we ain't going any further.
Yeah, exactly. Now, Beryl, you're writing about this.
Well, we're going to be writing about it next week. As far as Bill 104 goes, the law and it being struck down, but of course that's particular to these families. But Brent Howe is going to be writing about that. I'm going to be editorializing very much along the lines of the theme that John, I've been carrying around this article of John's for 3 weeks, dying to read this first paragraph when John wrote, "Time for Quebec to put aside gripes." And as John says, Quebec has defined itself as a grievance society. And that's so to the heart of the matter of the Quebec question and what does Quebec want. Not only it is a grievance society because it's been sold as bill of goods, that it has a moral superiority because of a great injustice done to a native people in its native land, and nothing could be further from the truth, of course, historically, and history matters. But as John says, both in the article and today, I'm not sure that Quebec has leaders of political courage to reverse that. Whether you're Benoit Peltier or Mario Dumont, you know, whether you're separatist or not, it looks like everybody's sounding like an autonomist.
Or Stephen Harper. John, your take, you know, now after having spent time in Quebec and right down in the hinterland, in the heartland, did you get a better sense of what of whether Quebec or whether Quebecers at that level believe in this instinctively, or whether this is foisted off on them by the chattering class en français?
Well, I think there is an instinctive nationalism. I mean, I don't think there's any doubt about that. I got the sense that whereas it used to be a political necessity that Quebec be independent, that is no longer the case. It might be desirable, but it's not necessary given the disruption and dislocation that would result from that. I was staying with a family, a 50-year-old guy who had been a separatist all his life, and he no longer even voted separatist. He looked at Dumont as a somehow being able to muddle through that kind of difficult dilemma. And his wife was telling me his kids don't want to have anything to do with this. You know, one of them's in Burkina Faso, the other one's in Montreal, one's in Vancouver. I mean, they're citizens of the world now. They don't want to be part of some you know, backwater gulag that that doesn't give them access to the opportunities which they have now.
That's a real indictment. You've seen this in Scotland. Quebecers, have they evolved? Have they evolved past the time where they will ever need the touchstone of independence, or do you think that they will always want that security blanket?
Well, I don't know. I mean, there are real differences with Scotland and with Quebec. I mean, the model of Ireland has been shown to succeed, and Scotland, as a small, mobile, maneuverable country that could move its tax rates up and down to its own advantage. You know, you lower the tax rate and you increase the overall tax take. Well, that's what happened in Ireland. Scotland could do that. England couldn't respond because its overall tax take would go down. So there is a model to follow there. I don't think there's a model in North America. I mean, I don't see Quebec being anywhere close to what Ireland has become, for example. The mentality is far too corporatist and to my mind, backward. Whether it will go away, I mean, I think it's part of that. It's in the heart. Whether it ever goes to the heart and the head, I don't see it.
So we've got to take a quick break here. John Iveson of the National Post, Beryl Wiseman of the Institute of Public Affairs of Montreal and the Montreal Suburban, standing by. This is the Remains of the Week on 940 Montreal. I'm Jim Duff. In the remaining moments of the Remains of the Week, with Beryl Wiseman and John Iveson of the National Post, I want you both to look ahead at the resumption of Parliament, or September 17th, I think the House gets back. And John, I wanted to get your sense of whether you think that the Harper, what will the strategy be facing as the Harper government comes back, facing a possible non-confidence motion from the Bloc, and perhaps not the Liberals joining it. What do you think is going to happen?
Well, I don't see that happening at all. I don't think the Bloc won an election. I mean, they're not high in the polls. The Liberals certainly don't. Nobody's going to gain from this. So at the moment, I think it's a game of chicken. I think we're going to probably go through until 2009, October, which is when the Fixed Election Act has set the date of the next election. And I think Mr. Harper is going to govern in a completely different style. I think it's going to be more inclusive. It's going to be less... This is, you know, they have pretty much said, you know, it's our way or the highway. I think we're going to see a toned-down Harper government in the next year or so.
Okay, what about Afghanistan, John?
Well, he has at least set the narrative for consultation with Parliament. I think he's laid the ground rules for getting out of Afghanistan. I mean, the narrative will be that if Parliament says we're getting out in 2009 or we're not going to be in the combat role in Kandahar, then that gives cover to Stephen Harper to do that. I think that's probably what will happen now. I mean, it doesn't seem, he says he wants a consensus in Parliament. Well, he's not going to get that if he wants to continue the combat mission in Kandahar.
Yeah, exactly. So, Beryl?
I agree completely with John about the date of the election, the unwillingness and the inability, of course, of the other parties to run an election right now. But I'm not sure that we're going to see a more inclusive Harper. I kind of feel, and this is strictly intuition, that with Bernie and Vernier's appointments, we're going to see maybe a more aggressive pushing of the Harper agenda, particularly in Quebec, because there's really no other party that's at all organized. The Liberals are really in disarray. 20 months after the last election, their finances are in shambles. A lot of their riding association in shambles. The NDP is really irrelevant. Yeah. So the Bloc Québécois has internal fratricide right now. I don't know. I just have a suspicion that maybe we'll be seeing a little it kicked up a notch, and maybe that'll just give him that 3-4 points extra that he needs.
Well, all I would say to that is that they have been the way of governing at the moment has been campaign all the time.
Yeah.
And I don't think that's the way that they're going to continue on. I think that they've realized that there's a cost to the country of being in permanent campaign mode, and that means that there are no long-term decisions being made. And they know that if they want to come to an election in 2009 and say, here's what we've done, they've got to have some longer-term goals achieved. I mean, productivity, for example, has not been addressed. All the budgets so far have been all about electoral gimmicks and short-term hits.
Gentlemen, we'll see how it plays down, but right now we are out of time. Right. John Iveson, thanks very much for your time. Appreciate it.
Okay.
John, have a good weekend. Jim, take care.
Yeah, John Iveson of the National Post, Beryl Wiseman, Institute of Public Affairs of Montreal. That's it for me.
And oh, thank new barricades very much. Is out, by the way.
Oh, the new barricades is out?
Casualties
okay,
of war
well,
is the cover.
Well,
part.
You can plug it on your show on Sunday.
Yeah, but I wanted to share with you. It just came from the printers.
All righty. Beryl Wiseman. Thank you very much to Tor Shogren and to Sabrina Marandola and to Debbie Marcellus and to everybody else that helped get the show to air. And thank you for listening. We're back on Monday. Well.